So I hope that you have questions, because this conversation is going to go as far as your questions go. So we can just sit here for 30 minutes silently, staring at each other and creating more anxiety for you. But is there any questions for Philip, for myself? Also, thank you, Philip, being voluntold to be here. Appreciate it. For me, either from my message from last night or from anything that Jeff taught today, if you weren't here last night, there's a little piece of paper on your packet with my entire outline that you can look at it and reference back to it. So any questions, feel free to just raise your hand and we'll call on you.
Yeah, I think it ebbed and flowed for her. There was seasons where she felt unstuck, and there's times that she would come back and it was really dark for her. I think that's the journey of someone who's trying to walk alongside one who is wrestling with depression, not to give up, to kind of be that presence for that person to help them to know that there's someone that they can go to and work it through. She called me. We haven't met for probably over 5 years now, but she calls me almost every year saying, hey, how you doing, and so forth. So it's always good to hear her voice and knowing that God is still keeping her going. And I don't think much of her circumstances have changed on why it was so heavy for her to live life. But I do think she has some more things in place. A lot of times it's just trying to give people tools in their toolbox to help them kind of grow and to kind of help them. And maybe that's probably what helped you. Like there's some meditating scripture or a variety of things that could be helpful to kind of toolbox that help you to remember God. Because I would have to continue to remind her that God saw her beautiful, because she felt like she didn't feel beautiful. She felt like she was trying to always be somebody that somebody else wanted her to be. And just remind her how that God is for her and with her, that he hasn't left her, that he understands her struggle. I think when she understood that Jesus really understood her struggle, that really was freeing time for her. Didn't solve everything, but it felt like it gave her hope in the midst of the darkness that she was wrestling with, that she was not alone. I don't know if that's helpful. A good book by Ed Welsh is called Depression, A Stubborn Darkness. So it's a good book either if you're dealing with depression or not, or you're trying to help someone who's dealing with depression. It's a good thesis of things to think about. And just that person was also, she saw a psychiatrist, so she was on medication. And sometimes that's helpful, right? Because a lot of times you can do work when medication helps settles a person down sometimes, and so that helps able to do the heart work that our counselors are trained and called to do, the spiritual heart work. Does that make sense? A stubborn darkness. Depression, A Stubborn Darkness. Yeah. It's been different titles at different times. Anything by Ed Welsh on that would be good. A biblical counselor. it depends on how, so if someone comes to us in that situation, like in our practice, we would kind of do evaluation to see where that person is. And then if we feel like she does need to see, or he or she needs to see a psychiatrist, just to see if there's medication that would be helpful for them, then we would refer out. A lot of times, though, it doesn't have to happen that way. They can start building trust and relationship with the counselor, and they can help them walk through that journey. But sometimes there is times where we need that extra help. Medical assistance.
One thing we would say here is that it doesn't have to be an either or. That if you are going, if you're going to see someone who's a professional in a particular field outside of the church, you should also have a support structure within the church. On Wednesday night, I was at an event talking about these topics, and someone asked a question, just kind of listed the different types of care that are available, and asked, like, where do we start? What kinds of things should go to which professional? And the panelist said, the statistics show that there isn't a difference in efficacy on the different types of professionals. The things are, do you have a good rapport with the person you're talking to? And is there a support structure outside of that one-on-one meeting? So that would be the one thing we say. It's like, don't obsess over, you know, who's the right particular specialty for this situation, but build trust with somebody to be able to talk through those things. And then as a church, we try to say, if there's something is a heart issue, this is about what I desire, about what I fear, it's about idols, I want the most biblical person you can give me, a person who's walking with Jesus and who can apply scripture to my life. If there is something that is, like if I have cancer, I want the best oncologist I can get, and I don't care that much if he's a Christian or not. And if it's something where there is actual neurological, you know, issues, then yeah, just give me a great doctor. But in general, when we're talking about concerns of the heart, the things we've been talking about today, is like, let's get the best biblically grounded person that you can get. So.
I would echo, it is, you know, even as we counsel people in our practice, we always ask, hey, are there people in your church that can walk with you? Because eventually we're going to be finished with counseling situation usually. But we want them to have something in place before they leave that knows their story, that can walk with them. So that's good. That support structure is essential in our growth. I mean, God designed us that way, right? Not just to be individual Christians, but to be corporate together, living life together. Of this church. I definitely have an answer to that, but
yeah, it's obviously it's an abstract intellectual question for some people, but it's a very personal question for others who have had, you know, close friends or family members who've taken their lives, and so obviously a lot of sensitivity is called for there. I don't think there's anything in scripture that would indicate that it's that's the unforgivable sin. There's nothing unique about that. We would say that it is sinful, that we don't have the right to do that. But a Christian, being a Christian, does not prevent you from the capacity to commit sin. Any sin is still, we're still able to commit sin. And so someone taking their own life or being stuck in a pattern that leads them to that place is not proof that they are not in Christ. And so I think that's, it's unfortunate that has that connotation. I understand why, where that comes from. But yeah, I don't think it's helpful at all to kind of have this idea of unforgiveness attached to the taking one's own life.
Right, because I think to add to that, the understanding of forgiveness comes from what Christ has done, not what we do or what we fail to do. So understanding that forgiveness comes through our faith in Christ, understanding that it is not by our works that we are saved, but by God's good grace, helps us to understand that not just with suicide, with any other sin that we might think, how can we ever come back from that? The reality is that it is God's grace that saves us, not anything else. Good question.
I would just add, if people are asking those questions, if you have a friend asking those questions, like, dig a little bit deeper. Yeah. I know, but I'm saying, for anybody, when that topic comes up, I had a guy that I was in youth group with that I discipled and baptized him, and he took his own life when we first went to, we just left for China at that point. And he had been asking questions like that, and I wasn't picking up on it, that it was not an abstract question for him. And so I just encourage you guys to take that a step further and say, hey, how are you doing? What's going on?
Sure. Well, first, our resource, Good and Angry by David Pollison, probably one of the best works on how to work through anger. Because there's a lot of justice issues related to anger, right? And so it's not necessarily wrong to be angry over injustices. God is angry over sin, right? And he punished sin on Christ, right? In that sense. Even in the Psalms today, they were angry, like they're in pain because of injustices. And so it's not necessarily wrong to be angry over something. I think how it then fleshes out on is how we express that anger, right? How are we working through it? How did Jesus work through it, right? He was angry when he saw the temple being... what's the right word? I'm glad I'm just... Yeah, right. It's defiled. Thank you. Thank you for filling in the blanks. So there's something good about... I mean, it's good to be angry over unholy things, right? If you've been sinned against, it's okay to be angry over that. The check is okay. I can't live in unforgiveness. I can't live in bitterness and resentful. And that's where you have to kind of... I think you would have to process that probably with someone to help you work through that. And I'm not saying you do, but in general, you have to work through that with someone to see what's causing you to maybe respond in sinful ways, angry in sinful ways, right? Anger is such a huge topic. I mean, so it's hard to give, can really answer that question with, because there's so many other angles I could probably take, but I don't know if that's helpful or not. Let me say this. I mean, if you're feeling angry, go to God and express it, right? And I mean, kind of what we learned today in Psalms, don't feel guilty running to God over it, right? And seeking God to say, okay, help me to correct my way of thinking if it's wrong. So I think, again, it's knowing that you have a God who delights to help you wrestle through that anger in really healthy, good ways.
I just want to second his recommendation of Good and Angry. We read through it with my small group this past year, and it's very clear. I think anger is an especially moral emotion, that it's making a value judgment that something is wrong. And then Pollison goes on, he says, you know, that's wrong and it matters. And anger can be destructive as it's coming towards a thing and saying, like, and I'm going to come and destroy you. I'm coming for not for your good. And God comes towards us, and he says, that's wrong, and it matters, and I'm going to come towards you to heal you. And that's Pallison, you know, he's very wordy at times, and so he says it's a constructive displeasure of mercy. But there's a very, it's very clarifying for me reading that, of what, where anger can be good and necessary. And then often it just, it's an emotion and a value judgment that gets away from us. And so it becomes something that we are doing to something that happens to us pretty quickly. And so you do need to talk through that, figure out what's going on. And unfortunately, I think you're right that often in the church, it's, yeah, we talk about it in a uniformly negative way. And have a little grace for your preachers. We can't caveat everything in a 35-minute sermon. We can't explain every nuance. No. Well, you still can't nuance everything in an hour. Yeah. But it's a really...
The phrase again? Say that again, that Pallison says?
The constructive displeasure of mercy.
That's so weighty. I mean, I've read that book multiple times, and I still kind of read that chapter. It's a good chapter.
I could add something. I think, thanks, Rob. I was in the same event that Philip went to. I was not there, but I was there virtually. So I was technically in a way there. The guy who was actually speaking, he said something that really caught my attention. He said, we have acres of emotions inside of us that cannot be explored unless we have somebody actually asking the proper questions. Sometimes with emotions, we need to untangle those emotions, and we need somebody, that is a book, we need somebody to help us to untangle those emotions. And that kind of prefaces something that I was going to say to you guys regardless, which is my joy of being your pastor comes in seeing you grow in your faith and seeing you trust the Lord more and more. And I love getting to know all of you, and my joy is meeting with one of you, with any of you. So never feel like you can't come up to me or I'm too busy to talk. I am more than happy. I know that Philip would say the same thing, but I'm not going to volunteer his time. But I know he would say the same thing. But anytime you need to talk and you need to just untangle an emotion, or you need just somebody to be even a listening ear in an age where listening ears are missing, I offer it. Yes, Joy.
Since we're just on a CCEF kick, CCEF is the organization that Ed Welch and David Pallison and Paul David Tripp worked for. There's a little article called X-Ray Questions that has, it's X-ray, called X-ray Questions, that helps get at the heart. But, I mean, a lot of times there's not a bad question if you're just curious and you're willing to ask three more questions and say, why are you feeling that way? Tell me more about that. I think at a certain point you can ask questions about what people want, what they're afraid of, and things that are getting closer to the heart. And often if you're paying attention to what people are saying about their emotions, that's a window into their heart. So as people are talking to you, pay attention to, you know, anything they're referencing their emotions, right? and pull on that thread a little bit.
I think the rule of three whys helps a lot. How are you really doing? Why? 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 I know that sounds really repetitive and kind of monotonous, but I think, as Philip was saying, as you press in into somebody, if somebody says, I'm good, I'm like, okay, but how are you really doing? Or why are you good? Or why was it heavy? And I mean, it's a learned practice to be able to read just somebody's emotions and faces and even body language. But the more you do it, the more you're just open to actually listening to how people are doing. when people say I'm good, but their entire body language says otherwise, you don't be afraid to be like, hey, actually, I noticed that answer wasn't necessarily too genuine. Like, how are you actually really doing? I think in a small group like this, I know that this is the big young adult event, but yet we're still a small group. And we have our own small little groups within this small group where I would encourage you to ask those questions. I appreciate how people are open and want to share, and some people just need a little bit more prying. But you also don't have to pry everything open. I think you just trust the Lord to guide you in conversations.
I think a lot of times it's trust. Like, if you're trying to follow with someone, do that person trust that you really do care about what you're asking? And so I just think that's important as you think about how, if you want to follow up with someone, you know, do they think that this is a safe place for me to kind of share more with you, or, you know, with another person? So I think, again, just trust is important. I think it does depend contextually kind of where people are. I try to help them try to say, kind of uncover their, you know, why are you believing that? What are some of the foundations of why you're believing that? A lot of times you need to kind of go back in history, because usually history can speak volume to why they're responding to things now. So sometimes a basic question may be a good start, but sometimes you have to kind of uncover, understand historically what people have experienced for them to kind of really come to a point where they understand what actually is, why they're responding the way that they're responding. In part of my discussion, I usually ask, okay, where's, just so I can understand where the relationship with God is, and say, okay, where is God for you in these times when you have those, you have the, as you're feeling this way or feeling that way, just to see where they're bringing God into the picture. Again, not to judge, just to help me understand kind of where is God, how is God playing a part in their processing what's going on in their lives. I'm not saying that's the first question I ask, but it's a question that I like to get around to.
We have time for like two more questions.
Sometimes, and you have history with that person too, right? And so that helps.
There was an event last year for the school where Dave Brewer was, he used to be the 1031 pastor here for a while, and he was talking to parents about working with their own teens, and he said something really stuck with me, that like the connection between people is the bridge, mm-hmm. and you can't drive semi-trucks over rope bridges. So you have these weighty conversations, these very difficult conversations you're trying to have with somebody, but you have a, you know, like jungle rope bridge connection with that person, it's not going to work. And so you need to build trust before you try to have those really difficult conversations. And so what he was saying about, like, do I follow up on this, that is based somewhat on what is my role in this person's life? Do we have the kind of connection where I can ask a follow-up? And a lot of times in our day and age, there's like, we don't have a ton of trusting relationships, so the main work that we need to do is build the connection stronger with people. And so if your attachment to other people is just a couple little rope bridges, you need to build community a lot more, and then those conversations happen a lot easier. That analogy doesn't look like it made sense to you, Joy.
I don't know what
lot of times it's, as you hear what they say, it's following up with a question. Like a dear friend, I get really angry over the situation. I got angry because someone cut me off. Like saying, okay, help me understand that. What was that? Why was that such an important thing that caused you to be angry? And it's kind of just being actively listening and kind of just, and maybe your role is to point them to God. I wouldn't diminish that role. But it's just, it might, you don't want to go too quickly, and you learn it, and sometimes you learn that. I mean, you have to confess, like, hey, I think I rushed you here, I'm sorry, let's go back a little bit more, I need to understand that more, instead of, we want to give a solution, we want to lead them to the solution, but we're not the solution, we don't have to fix them. I think that's what happens a lot. We want to fix one another, we're uncomfortable with what that person is feeling or dealing with, and so we want to get quickly say, well, you need to do this, this, and this, and what they actually need is just someone to sit with, listen with, and then kind of engage them, you know. Good questions are important, but if you ask a bad question, God is still in control and he's doing something, so go back and say, hey, that was a really stupid question I asked. I mean, I've done that plenty of times. Do that to my kids all the time. Like, that was dumb, you know, right? Or they'll let me know that was a dumb question. It's like, oh, yeah, okay.
One more question?
So my kids will say, they'll say, Dad, if you counsel like you counsel us, I'm not sure if you're a very good counselor. I was like, yeah, I do a better job with other people.
We got time for one more question.
Don't be shy.
Can I check the Google Doc?
Yeah, there is a total of zero. You did?
Yeah, Roddy.
Oh, dude, my bad.
Oh, no.
Hold on.
Now he's not anonymous anymore.
It didn't.
I can ask.
It didn't, like, load up on my
thing. To ask it, yeah.
I can ask.
Sorry, Joe. Hey, oh, I mean, Thomas, for anonymity purposes.
Everyone close your eyes and someone will ask a question. No, my question was, it seems like mental health is talked about more today than probably ever.
It's a good thing.
However, depression and suicide rates seem to be higher than ever as well. And one of my questions was, do you think that the mental health discussion is a response to that?
So let me understand. If I understand, I'm going to reinterpret what you're
saying,
and just to make sure I'm. Do you believe? So you're saying, do you feel like the more openness of our talking about mental illness has normalized depression and suicide? Okay.
Not necessarily. And I'm asking, do you think it's for that, or
yeah, I mean, that's a good, very good, interesting question. I never really I have not thought of that correlation. Not that it, but I do think it's been healthy for the church, at least, to acknowledge, because of the fall, mental illness is an issue just like any other physical disease or physical condition we might have. So I think it's been healthy for the church to be open to. I mean, I don't know. If, I mean, our family has been, my nephew committed suicide, right, when he was 25, 26, so it's very real. But I think we thought that he needed help and he refused it, right? And so he didn't want to talk about that he needed help. So I'm just talking out loud. So It's an interesting question. I don't know if there's been studies that have shown that more we talk about it, that more people are going to be depressed. And I do think the pandemic has, I think, it feels like it has accelerated that. People are feeling depressed and more suicidal. I don't want to blame the pandemic, but I think it has kind of, it feels like it's moved us more where people are choosing suicide. I don't know if you choose depression. I think depression is something that you kind of you kind of wrestle with. I don't know if you have a better answer.
Different maybe. But, the event on Wednesday night, someone asked a similar question, and the counselor said, if you ask 50 different professionals this question, you're going to get 50 different theories about why the rates are up. Certainly, a lot of people are going to talk about social media, talk about isolation, and talk about the pressure on achievement in our society. Mm-hmm. The definition of the good life is very narrow, and people, when you close the ceiling off and there's no transcendent anything, everything is on your shoulders to make, to achieve a good life, and it's very competitive. And so that is not unique to our society. Having lived in China for a while, it's very similar, and there's a lot of depression and anxiety. And it's very clear correlations between cell phone use, introduction of social media, and the rise of anxiety. There's comparison in that, and then there's bad habits that disrupt our sleep, and just the screen addiction that comes with that. So there's a lot of different pieces. I do think when a society in general forgets God, there's also going to be more, people are going to be grasping for things.
So. And that's by more than kind of holistic answer. I do think it's not more, I don't think it's more talking about it. I do think it's more, there's other elements that you were talking about. Just all those other exterior pressures that that often we face.
One thing though that's different is that Gen Z in particular, millennials a little bit, but Gen Z even more, are willing, like there's no stigma around these issues, and they're willing to self-diagnose on a whole range of issues.
Oh, yes. Correct.
Right. And so,
good point. Good point.
Yeah, one of the things that it's like, what, for a particular person, what is that title, what does that diagnosis mean for them? How is it functioning in their life? That's an important thing. And a lot of these things are, a spectrum of severity, the duration, frequency, severity. And so it might be right that someone is kind of saying, I am XYZ thing, but it's not nearly as severe as what would have been diagnosed 10 or 15 years ago. And so you don't want to discount it. You don't want to just brush people off. That diagnosis, that title means something to that person.
I think also on the professional side, I think sometimes we conclude too quickly on what people are doing or being or feeling. So I think we're like, oh yeah, you're depressed, or yeah, you're this, or oh yeah, you're that. Where maybe that's an error that they're wrestling with, but it's not necessarily. I think as professionals, sometimes we're too quick to put people in categories. That's what I'm trying to say as well. So it's just not Gen Z's doing that. I think sometimes professionals are doing that, not in a good way.
Right. There's a guy, Mark Sayers, who is kind of a thinker, theologian, and he described our culture as if there's three buckets of freedom, meaning or purpose, and community. And our Western culture has put all of our eggs in the freedom basket. So like our independence and freedom bucket is filled up and overflowing, and we have no purpose and no community. And that's a recipe for a lot of anxiety. Because actually having a ton of independence and autonomy means you're making choices about everything, and we have to create our own identity that is, you know, supposed to be meaningful to the people around us. Say like, look in my super independent creative life that I'm building from the ground up. And it's not attached to any particular community, and it has no transcendent meaning. And so I think that is, you know, that's one way of looking at it, but it's certainly understandable why anxiety would be increasing in our society.
Thank you, guys. Can we give Jeff a hand for...
It was a joy. I enjoyed hanging out with you, getting to know some of you. It was a lot of fun.